afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We open the phone lines for you. You can call in if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian life or the Christian faith. Excuse me. Or if you have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to bring that up, feel free to call me right now or sometime in the coming hour. Just a heads up, it's usually wiser to try to call earlier in the program, as I think yesterday and sometimes, excuse me for clearing my throat, we end up having to go off the air at the end of the hour, sometimes with calls waiting to go on, which I don't like. I don't like to have to end the show when there's people who wanted to be on the show and didn't get a chance. But the best way to avoid being that person is to call early and just wait online and stay on your phone, by the way. Don't call and get on hold and then walk away from your phone and listen to the radio, because when I call your name, you won't hear it on the radio for several seconds, maybe a half a minute or so, after it's really coming across the air. So you need to stay on the phone so you don't get fooled by the delay on the air. Okay, the number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And I want to remember to say this. I often get, I start taking the calls and I forget to make the announcements. I've been telling you all week that I'll be in Hollister, California, and Santa Cruz, California, this weekend. In fact, tomorrow night, I'll be speaking in Hollister, and Saturday night, I'll be speaking in Santa Cruz. The locations of these meetings can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under the Announcements tab. In Hollister tomorrow night, I'll be speaking on the subject, how can we know that the Bible is true? Can we really? I think we can, and there's some very good rational reasons. In fact, I would say there's far better reasons for us affirming that the Bible is true than anybody has yet come up with for denying it. And I say that with a mind to take on any one's objections. We'll have questions and answers afterward. So if you're interested in coming to that, hearing that, bringing a friend, a teenage child, or a teenage young person, a skeptic, feel free. We'll be glad to see you tomorrow night in Hollister, California. The information is at the website, thenarrowpath.com, under the tab that says Announcements. That is speaking tomorrow night on the subject, how can we know the Bible is true? Now, the next night, Saturday night, I'm speaking in Santa Cruz, and I've got a different topic. I'll be speaking on a Christian response to same-sex marriage. Obviously, a very timely subject for Christians to be thinking about. So if you're interested in that subject and you want to bring along anybody who's got views other than Christian views on it, I'll be glad to take questions and answers after that talk as well. That's in Santa Cruz. The topic is a Christian response to same-sex marriage. So that's tomorrow night and the next night. Both of them are subjects that could benefit friends of yours who are not Christians, and feel free to bring them along, and I'll let them ask their questions in the Q&A afterwards. All right, our lines are full right now, so if you called right now, you would not get through, but you want to take down this number, because calls will be, lines will be opening up, and we can take your calls. The number is 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Richard, calling from Phoenix, Arizona. Richard, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Good talking to you again, Steve. How are you doing?
Well, thank you.
Good. I just had a couple of quick questions. They're really quick. Did you finish the Zechariah study that you recently were doing?
Yes. Yes, we did the whole book of Zechariah this in July. And the lectures, the recordings, will be posted before very long. The man who is editing them is moving right along, as I understand it.
Oh, okay, good. Well, so, that could be, a couple of weeks or something?
I hope it wouldn't be more than that. I have not talked to him for a little bit, and I will do so as soon as I can.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, that's really all I want to know. Enjoy your program. Listen to it almost daily, and it's been a real blessing. So keep up the good work, and we're praying for you, and we'll talk to you another time.
Okay, Richard, thanks for your call. And Richard was calling from Phoenix, which is one of our newer areas. The only areas we're on now that are newer markets for us are San Francisco, Boise, and Albuquerque. But we're still fairly new in the Phoenix area, enough so that I have not visited Phoenix since we've been on the air there. And therefore, I've never had a time, FaceTime, you know, to connect with our listeners there. I announce here frequently that I'm going to be here or there speaking, and all of these places that I go are places where we're on the air and where listeners come out and we get to meet each other and so forth. But I haven't done that in Phoenix yet. And as a matter of fact, just as of yesterday, I was asked to consider doing that. So for our Phoenix area listeners, I'm going to be probably planning a trip to come and speak in the Phoenix area in the near future, but I don't know when that will be. If any of our Phoenix listeners want to be a part of that, want to suggest a venue, want to have any input about that, feel free to email me, steve@thenarrowpath.com. You can just email me, steve@thenarrowpath.com. Okay, our next caller today is Laura from Bremerton, Washington. Laura, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, Steve, and I want you to know how much I appreciate your program. I don't get to listen to it much, but again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question is concerning Israel. I'm not by any means a scholar, but I tend to find myself vacillating over how I feel or think about Israel in regards to the church. I love Israel. I love the land of Israel. I have been there. I have an affinity for these people because you can't read the Old Testament without seeing God's heart for the Jews.
I hear you.
But I just keep vacillating. I don't really believe in replacement theology. I do not think I do. But I just am having a hard time reconciling how much emphasis we should put on Israel. You know, I've heard teaching that it's not about the land anymore. It's not about Jerusalem. It's not about the Jews. But I don't see how that's possible by my reading of Scripture.
Well, it depends on if you're reading the Old Testament or the New Testament, really. Because there are many things in the Old Testament that make it very clear that Israel is God's chosen people and Jerusalem was the capital of the promised land and so forth. In the New Testament, we don't have any discussion of that at all. The closest thing you get to that in the New Testament is Romans chapter 11, and it doesn't mention anything about Jerusalem or the promised land at all. It says all Israel will be saved, but nobody believes, at least nobody I know, and no one I've ever heard, believes that means every last Jew will be saved. Even the strongest dispensationalists usually mean, well, that just means there will be a widespread turning to God within Israel. It doesn't mean there won't be any atheist Jews left in the world or whatever. So, in other words, nobody I know believes that every Jew is going to be saved. But there are many who believe there will be a great turning to God among the Jewish people in the end times. And they often base it on Romans 11. But Romans 11 doesn't say anything about the promised land, doesn't say anything about people going there or Jerusalem or whatever. You just don't find anything in the New Testament on that subject. So that would be an observation I'd bring to your attention. as far as how we think of Israel, I think we should think about Israel the way we think about other nations, because that's how God thinks about it. In the Old Testament, the prophets would, like Amos, for example, would write two chapters where he's condemning the various nations, and he condemns Edom, and he condemns Moab, and he condemns Ammon, and he condemns, Syria, and he condemns Egypt, and then he condemns Judah because of their sins. And similarly, in Leviticus, God told the people of Israel that the reason he was driving the Canaanites out of the land of Canaan and giving it to Israel was because the Canaanites had done abominable things. And he said, I'm causing the land to vomit them out, and you're going in their place. Well, he said, but if you do the same abominable things, then the land will vomit you out too. In other words, there never was a time when Israel was somehow exempt from the same judgment that God brought on other nations. Where Israel had an advantage is they had a revelation from God. He let them know what his will was. He made a covenant with them based upon their obedience. They could be specially treated by him. This is very clear, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 28 or Leviticus chapter 26. God makes it clear, if you keep my covenant and obey my ways, you'll receive special treatment that other nations don't have, because you'll be in a covenant relationship. You'll be my people in this world. You'll be my kingdom of priests. But he said, if you do all the same wicked things that the other nations do, well, then you'll be wiped out. You know, I mean, in other words, there never was a situation in the Old Testament, and certainly not in the New, where it would be said that Israel, regardless what they do, will always be blessed by God. But he did bless them in making a covenant with them and giving them the opportunity, which he did not give to any other nation in Old Testament times, gave them the opportunity to know him and his ways and to follow him if they would. Unfortunately, as you read the Old Testament, it doesn't look like they did. And so they got thrown out of the land twice, once in 586 BC when the Babylonians took them away, and another time in AD 70 when the Romans took them away, and they've never really come back yet. I know there's Jews there. There's been a reestablishment of a political nation there, and the city of Jerusalem is there, of course. But most of the Jews of the world still live elsewhere. Most of the Jews live in Russia and America and Poland and other parts of the world, not Israel. So the fact remains that they have never really been restored. This is one reason why many rabbis say that Jesus can't be the Messiah, because it is their belief that when the Messiah comes, he'll regather the Jews from all over the world, the diaspora, back into Israel. And Jesus didn't do that. And they say that's why they don't believe he was the Messiah. Well, he didn't do that. And I guess maybe their expectations should be readjusted, because Jesus is the Messiah, but he didn't do what they expected the Messiah to do. That is no doubt why many of the Jews participated in condemning him and taking him to Pilate and getting him crucified, because he didn't do what they thought the Messiah should do. But he did what the Messiah really should do. They just were reading things wrongly. Now, when we look at the nation of Israel, what we see is just like every other nation. Some of the people there are Christians. There are people in Israel, Jewish people, who recognize Christ as the Messiah, Jesus as the Messiah, and are following him, just like that's the case in America or Brazil or China or Kenya or Sweden or almost any other country you want to name. There's some people there who follow Jesus. The rest are in rebellion against Jesus. In the case of Israel, as in every other country, that's the majority. The vast majority of the people in Israel are like the vast majority of people elsewhere. They aren't following Jesus. They're rejecting Jesus. Many of them are atheists. Many of them follow Judaism, which is a rejection of Jesus. Many of them are Buddhists or New Age or have some other belief system. But Israel's just about like every other nation. And if they're not following Jesus, then they are not obeying God. And if they're not obeying God, then even the Old Testament says that they don't have any special privileges unless they do. Now, many dispensationalists would say that, but that's going to change. Someday the majority of the people in Israel are going to serve God, and then they'll be specially blessed. Well, maybe they will. Maybe they won't. I don't know if that's true. I read Romans 11 a little differently than that, and there's no other New Testament passages that address the question. So I would say at this point, my position toward Israel is that I would evaluate Israel as far as whether I'd give it my support or not, case by case, based on its behavior. Because Israel can be more righteous than its neighbor nations, but it can be just as bad as them too, maybe worse sometimes. So we really have to judge Israel like any other nation, because the prophets did, Moses did. I mean, there never was a time in the Old Testament where Israel was not subject to the same judgment as the rest of the nations. And for some reason, modern Christians often take the view that no matter what Israel does, God's on their side. And that was never true in the Old Testament, and it certainly doesn't appear to be true in the New Testament, so I'm not sure why it would be true now.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, I do have a similar view. I just have always felt that a remnant would be saved, but was wondering if Jerusalem was God's, his city, because he does call Jerusalem his, and I always just wonder if, yes, maybe the nation of Israel is all that you've said, but that there's still something about Jerusalem, and I don't know, because in Revelation, it talks about the new Jerusalem, and So I just
right. Now the new Jerusalem in Revelation is not an earthly city. It comes down from heaven. As you look in Revelation 21, it says, I saw the new Jerusalem descending from heaven, coming down to earth. Now, this is not a literal city that you could identify geographically on the planet right now, because it's in heaven right now. Paul referred to it as the Jerusalem which is above in Galatians 4. And the writer of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 12, said that we, Christians, have come to the heavenly Jerusalem, to the city of God, to Mount Zion, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven. So the writer of Hebrews said that the heavenly Jerusalem is the church, the general assembly and church of the firstborn. We could have deduced that from Revelation 21 also, since the city is said to be the bride, the Lamb's wife. Well, that'd be the church, would be Jesus' wife. So the new Jerusalem is not a literal city with a you know, an earthly footprint. It's a community. It's the community of Christ, really, and it's seen descending out of heaven. It is the mother of us all, and it is the Jerusalem that is above. So it should not be confused with the earthly Jerusalem. In fact, if you read Galatians chapter 4, Paul makes a very clear distinction between the Jerusalem that is on earth and the Jerusalem that is in heaven. He said the Jerusalem that now is, meaning the earthly Jerusalem, is in bondage with its children. He means in bondage to the law and the old covenant. But he says, but the Jerusalem which is above is free, which is the mother of us all. So he makes it very clear there's a distinction between the Jerusalem that's on the planet and the one that's above. Likewise, in Hebrews 11, it says that Abraham was not looking for an earthly land, but for a heavenly country. And it says, and it says God has prepared for them a city, which I believe is, again, the heavenly Jerusalem. So the city of Jerusalem that's standing right now, the New Testament contrasts it with the heavenly Jerusalem rather than identifies it with it. So I wouldn't make that particular link.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much.
Okay, Laura, thank you for your call.
Yeah.
God bless you. Oops, I didn't mean to cut you off. I thought you were done. Okay, our next caller is Robert from Portland, Oregon. Robert, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Along that same lines, and I hear your frustration about the pre-trib, which I believe, but...
I'm not frustrated about the pre-trib.
Well, I mean, okay, like John Hagee, he's capitalizing on it, and people take that too far.
Well, John Hagee's not just pre-trib; he's a heretic.
Right. I agree. You know, he seems like you said, he's making money on books, and you should refund them there in a month.
And he believes in dual covenant theology, which means he believes that Gentiles have to be saved through Christ, but Jews don't have to. Jews don't have to have Christ. They can be saved by keeping the old covenant, he thinks.
Yeah, that sounds completely heretical, yes.
Yeah.
But with Israel, like the Six-Day War and the 1948, where the five Arab nations came on them, weren't those won by God? I mean, there's like no human explanation for how they were one. Isn't that sort of miraculous?
It could be.
Think about that a little.
I mean, it could be miraculous. I know that God does intervene in geopolitics to cause, you know, certain nations to rise and others to fall. I believe, frankly, that God had something to do with the establishment of the United States a few hundred years ago. But that doesn't mean that we are God's chosen people, because I believe God had something to do with the establishment of many nations. In fact, you know, the Babylonian Empire when it swallowed up the whole region, Daniel, in Daniel chapter 2, said to the king of Babylon, he says, God in heaven has given you all the kingdoms of the world. You know, he's given you this empire. And so, in other words, the rise of one empire or the ascendancy of one over another is something that the Bible says God does. And for Israel in modern times to exist and to survive may very well involve some cases of God's intervention. God has intervened, at least there are reports of angels being involved in some of the battles of World War I and World War II. Whether these stories are true or not, I don't know, but I have no reason to say they're not. I mean, but they didn't have anything directly to do with Israel. So, I mean, God is involved in the affairs of men, and Israel may be one of many nations that has had some intervention from God in modern times. I don't know. All I can say is if we would decide that it was not God's intervention, we would say it is quite remarkable that Israel has shown itself to be quite a scrapper. In the midst of a lot of enemies, Israel has been tough, smart, and, frankly, crafty. And because of these things, and maybe because of God's intervention, but again, that's something we can't really say for sure, but at least for other reasons, we can see that Israel has shown itself more than the equal to her enemies. Of course, part of that can be attributed, I think, to the fact that Israel is a nation after the Western model. It's the Jews are smart, educated. Let's face it, even this country, some of the smartest people we've ever had were Jewish. I mean, Einstein, you know, he's Jewish.
Yeah, we're blessed by Israel.
Let's face it. Regardless of God's special blessing on the nation, Jews have often been some of the smartest people around. They're very often very talented and very technologically smart and so forth. So, I mean, Israel is a modern nation living in the 20th and 21st centuries. The Arab nations, in many respects, are ill-united, not always so high-tech, just not that organized. Israel's very organized, and they're very efficient. Now, that could be the blessing of God on them, or it might just be they're just real smart and techy and modern, whereas their enemies are kind of, backward, doing things the way they were done hundreds of years ago.
All right. See, thank you. I love your program. Have a great day.
All right. I appreciate your call. God bless you. Okay, let's talk next to, looks like, Ernestine. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thank you for calling from Las Vegas.
Yes, my name is Ernestine. How you doing?
Ernestine, welcome. Yes,
okay.
Good.
I'm confused. I found in your book the heading is Conspiracy Against Christ, and what I was looking for was the communion. And in Matthew 26, up above that it says Passover. So is the Last Supper and the Passover is the same thing?
Yes. Well, they're not the same thing, but one basically replaced the other. The Passover was the Jewish celebration of the founding of their nation, which happened at Mount Sinai when God made the covenant with them through Moses. And this happened because they had been recently delivered from bondage in Egypt. And God delivered them from bondage through the death of the firstborn among the Egyptians. And that was to be celebrated as Passover, forever afterward. Once a year, the Jews celebrate Passover. And what they celebrate is the deliverance of their people from Egypt by the supernatural intervention of God and his establishment of them as a nation under the old covenant. Now, when Jesus came, he was Jewish, and so he kept the Passover every year. And his disciples, once they began to travel with him, they kept Passover with him every year. But on the final Passover of his earthly life, he and his disciples met in the upper room, and he said, "With great desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." And as he began to, lead the ritual of the Passover meal, he began to redefine its meaning. And instead of remembering the Lamb and the escape and the sufferings of the people in Egypt and all those things that the Passover remembered, he said, this bread is my body, which is broken for you. This cup is my blood, the new covenant, my blood, which is shed for the remission of sins. And in other words, he took the Passover, which was under the old covenant, a celebration of Israel's founding as a nation, and he replaced its meaning. He said, from now on, when you do this, do it in remembrance of me. As often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, do it in remembrance of me. And what he meant by that was, instead of remembering the Exodus, I want you to remember me now. And so this became the foundation for what we call the Lord's Supper. Some groups call it communion or the Eucharist or something like that. But basically, it's a continuation of the Passover with a new meaning. The Jews who don't receive Christ still do the Passover in the older way because they don't recognize Christ. But Christians see a new meaning in it.
Okay. I just need to know, where do I find the new covenant of the Lord's Supper?
The new covenant of the Supper?
Well, I'm sort of confused. Okay.
Okay.
Where in the Bible do I find the Last Supper? I just want to read it from there and learn it.
Oh, okay. Well, you mentioned Matthew 26. That's one of the places.
Right.
It's recorded also in Mark and in Luke, but the Last Supper begins in Matthew 26, 17, I would say, and read on for. Certainly verse 26, he takes the bread and so forth. So that's where Matthew narrates it. Mark is going to narrate it probably in Mark chapter, I'm going to say 14. I'm going to take a look at it real quickly here. Yeah, it's Mark 14, beginning at verse 12. And then Luke is going to have it at probably chapter 22. Yeah, Luke 22, begin at verse 7. Then Paul, of course, talks about it as well over in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where he's sort of scolding the Corinthians for their neglect of the proper manner of taking it. And he, in 1 Corinthians 11, beginning at verse 17 and to the end of that chapter, also would discuss it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm a long-time listener and a first-time caller. You have been truly a blessing to me, and I thank you.
Thank you for calling. I appreciate it very much. God bless you.
God bless you, Mother.
All right. Bye now. All right. Irene from Sacramento, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question. My friend recommended me to listen to preaching of John Paul Jackson, and some ideas kind of unusual for me, I would say. So I need your opinion on this preacher, if it is valuable to learn, to listen to John Paul Jackson, or if there's any heresy in it. So I just don't want to, you know, to
right.
listen to something that is not available and not right.
Well,
so
I can say this. There are safer preachers to listen to than John Paul Jackson. I haven't heard much about him in the past 20 years. But back in the 90s, he was involved with some other people in what they called the New Prophetic Movement. It had sort of its center in Kansas City at the Kansas City Vineyard Church, at a church which now has become the International House of Prayer, the IHOP, they call it. And I, to tell you the truth, I heard things about him, and I may have even heard him preach on tape or something. I'm not sure if I did or not. But he was one of several pretty well-known guys associated with that movement, and they all considered themselves to be prophets. And they believed that God was restoring the prophetic office to the church in the last days and that they were it. Now, I haven't heard anything for a long time from him, so I can't really give you any up-to-date information. I don't know what he's teaching. I didn't even know he still was teaching. And I don't want to spread any kind of a rumor that's not true. You'd you might do your own research. But there was somebody in that movement, and I thought it was him, that had some charges brought against him for, I don't want to say what I'm not sure about, but as I definitely remember, there was news. Someone in that movement, I thought it was his name associated with it. There was some sexual impropriety. But don't pass that along without doing your own research. I haven't read anything about him in a long time. And I didn't know he still had people listening to him. He was like kind of one of the guys who was all the rage in a certain, group in the 90s. But I guess if he's still alive, he'd still be preaching. He's kind of passed from the spotlight. So I don't really know much about what he's doing now. But just what he was doing then, even if this scandal thing that I hinted at if it was someone else, I was pretty sure it was him. But if it wasn't him, just his teaching was, he's of that group that believes that God is trying to restore or is restoring the fivefold ministry to the church in the last days. And of course, people who believe that and teach that, at least the ones who spearhead that, always think that they are the ones that God is restoring. Interesting how that is. Cult leaders do exactly the same thing. Most ministers who don't have delusions of grandeur or designs on an unhealthy loyalty of their congregants, most ministers who are real men of God do not try to represent themselves as being eschatologically significant or, as some great one. And, even if they think that about themselves, I'd love to think that some of the things that I teach are things that God wants to restore to the church in the last days, but I can't make that claim. I'm as capable as being wrong as anyone else, it may be that some of the things I say are things that God wants to have said, but I trust that so, but I really have never thought of myself as significant. I'm just another person, searching the scriptures, trying to find out what's true and talking with other people, hearing what they have to say. But when someone makes himself be a significant player in something that God's doing in the end times, sort of on the, they're on the cutting edge where other people are not, I don't know, there's just something about that attitude that kind of stinks to me, and I've never liked it very much. There's some other guys whose names at least were associated with his very closely back in the 90s, and some of them had scandals too. I mean, Paul Kane was one of the prophets of that movement whose name was very prominent. In fact, he may have been the most respected one in the movement. And there were some scandals associated with him later on too, unfortunately. I guess I'd say why. If there's somebody who's had that kind of questionable teaching in the past, why? Why listen to him when there's so many other people who don't have that going on? I have such limited time to listen to people. I wouldn't put him on my short list of people that I wanted to listen to.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, Irene. Thank you. Bye now. Lloyd from San Francisco is our next caller, and we have a line open for you now if you'd like to call, if you've been waiting for an opportunity and you've been getting busy signals when you've called. Actually, there's two lines open right now, so if you call now, you can get through, and the program has maybe 20 minutes more to go. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Lloyd, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hello, Lloyd.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well.
You remember the last time I called? You may not remember.
Yeah, I remember.
Lord and I wanted to impress you and others of the seriousness of the book of Revelation. And I pointed out that it starts out the first verse of the first paragraph. Three sets of slaves involved in it, those who received.
Okay, but let me jump in here. I'll give you a chance to speak. But the last few times you've called, you've talked for a long time before I had any idea what it is you're calling about. Now, let me ask you this right up front. Do you have a question?
Well,
because sometimes I think you see yourself as a Bible teacher and you don't have an audience, so you'd like to use mine. But would you have something to share?
You, Do you see the seriousness of the fact that the book is given by and through slaves, to slaves, and that there's blessings at the beginning and the end of the book, and there's slaves all the way through the book? And let me read you two verses here, and then I'll ask you the question, okay? Two verses.
Okay.
Near the end of the book of Revelation, near the end of the Bible. I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this scroll, if anyone adds to them, God will add to him the plagues which are written in this scroll. And if anyone takes away from the words of the scroll of the prophecy, God will take away his part from the tree of life and from out of the holy city, which are written in this scroll. Okay, the point I want to make is this. God wants us to consider ourselves his slaves when we receive the words of this scroll. And if we minister them to others, he wants us to consider ourselves to be the slaves of Jesus Christ and minister his heart and his mind and receive the words coming from his heart and his mind and to keep them. Okay.
Okay. So that sounds to me more like a sermon than a question. Now, you kind of gave the semblance of a question when you said, do you think? And what I recall you asking is, do I think that it's significant or that it's important, that the book of Revelation is very important, and the fact that it's addressed to slaves? Well, you're making a big deal about slaves, where there's a very common word that's translated slaves or servants, usually servants, and they are the servants of God. Well, every Christian is that. He's not talking about people who are slaves in the sense of, captured by some other people and now they're household servants. I mean, there were lots of people like that. When Revelation was written, a lot of the people in the church were slaves in the sense of, socially, they actually were owned by slave masters. But, of course, that's not what he means. He's talking about people who see themselves as bond servants of God, which he trusts all Christians are. Now, if you're asking, do I think it's important that Christians see themselves as God's slaves? I do. Of course I do. And if you're asking, do I think that the book of Revelation is important? Of course. Of course it's very important. So do you have a question about that?
Well, the question is, it seems like a lot of times on your show, it's not necessarily bad, but people don't seem to want to know the mind and the heart of God in the book of Revelation.
Oh, really? I get a lot of questions from people asking about Revelation. Probably disproportionate number of questions come about the book of Revelation, which sounds like people are interested in knowing what God is saying there. So I'm not sure what day you were listening to that you got that impression.
No, well, the bottom line is this. You have openly said that you favor the amillennialist point of view.
Yes.
And I am just the opposite. And I came out of the Roman Catholic Church, which is the pillar of that Orthodox view. You call it the Orthodox view. And I know for a fact by talking to people who are ex-Presbyterians and they all have that same view. So I know those two groups of people have that view, and you have it. And I sincerely believe that God wants us to know that he is coming, and there will be a millennial reign, and it will last for whatever 1,000 years is.
Okay, now that's a very different point than you were making earlier. So that's what I mean about you talking a long time before I can figure out what you're asking about. You mentioned the Roman Catholic Church is the pillar of all millennialism. Well, the Roman Catholic Church was the only church in the West for about 1,000 years, and true, they did teach all millennialism. But Luther taught amillennialism. Calvin taught amillennialism. All the reformers were amillennial. Wesley, I'm pretty sure, was amillennial. And quite a few denominations of Protestants are amillennial now. So it's not really a Catholic doctrine. And it was taught before there were Roman Catholics. Or I should say before the Roman Catholic institution became what we call the Roman Catholic institution. Origen was amillennial, and he was nothing. He's not even part of the Western Church. He's in Alexandria, Egypt. One of the main theologians of his day in the third century was amillennial. Of course, Augustine was amillennial. And that was, although many people consider him the father of Roman Catholicism, he was not the father of amillennialism. It was around for 150 years at least, if not longer, before him. So I don't agree that the Roman Catholic Church is the pillar or the foundation of amillennialism. I think that amillennialism, which existed hundreds of years before there was a Roman Catholic papacy, and for 100 years afterwards, after the Reformation, it remained the main view of the church. So, but see, this is a really different kind of issue. You start out by asking, do I think the book of Revelation is important? I do. And then you make it sound like if I believe in amillennialism, that I don't think Revelation is important. I believe I'm reading Revelation. That's where I'm getting it from. Okay. It's in Revelation chapter 20. That's where the millennium is mentioned. And I'm interpreting it in light of the whole book of Scripture. And that's why I'm an amillennialist. I used to be, like yourself, a premillennialist. That's okay. People can go to heaven being premillennial. I don't mind if you're premillennial. But you don't take Revelation any more seriously than I do when you say that it's important for us to know that Jesus is coming back. Well, amillennialists believe that too. I believe it's important to know that Jesus is coming back. So, but you said it's important to note that he's coming back to establish a millennial kingdom. Well, if you are right, I'm not sure why that is important. As an amillennialist, I believe Jesus is coming back to establish a new heavens and new earth that lasts forever. You think he's going to start something that lasts only 1,000 years. Well, we disagree about that, and that's okay. Why would it be important? Why? What difference would it make in my life or your life if we believed one way or the other about that? In other words, let's say that, and this is not hypothetical, this is the case, you believe Jesus is going to come back and establish a 1,000-year reign. I believe Jesus is going to come back and establish an eternal reign on the new earth. Now, how are you going to live differently than I'm going to live? How is your discipleship going to be affected differently than mine by your opinion instead of having my opinion?
Chapter 17, verse 14. The 10 kings, after they destroyed Mr.
Okay, that's not... You didn't listen to me, did you? Okay, I'm not... I put you on hold here because it sounds like you've just got a sermon you want to preach. And you're not here to talk to me. You're here to just say what you want to say. Okay. And now, this is more of a give-and-take program. Even though I'm the host, even though a lot of the questions mostly are addressed to me, I still like to interact with people. But that requires listening to each other, and you're not listening to me. And so right now, since my lines are full, I can't listen to you anymore right now. You can call again, though, of course. Let's talk to Tim from Florida. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Tim. Thanks for calling.
Hey there, Steve. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'll try to be as concise as possible. In my journey the last couple of years, I was introduced by a pastor friend of mine that I met who was essentially a closet Christian universalist. And I've listened to your tapes on your website, you know, Three Views on Hell, Part 1 and Part 2. I have your book right now about you wrote about hell, and I haven't finished it, but I've gotten the premise from it. And I'm kind of torn on those issues. And as I'm kind of watching what's going on in the world right now, as a Christian, for example, this, you know, the woman in Kentucky and the whole debate about her issuing the marriage licenses. And, you know, you read all of the bantering that goes on between the Christians and the non-Christians right now. And I'm a Christian myself. I read a lot of these, you know, like I read an article on MSN about this clerk, and I read the comments at the bottom, and you see the Christians just being so nasty. And for example, I read one article, or excuse me, one comment someone made that used a Christian, you know, is getting ridiculous with, you know, defending this woman. And I'm not here to debate what she should do or not. I know there's some different views on that, even in the Christian world. But they use some quotes out of Proverbs chapter 1, verse 20, around 23 or so, and, you know, and 26, actually, Proverbs 1:26, and, you know, it's talking about, I will laugh at your calamity. I will mock at your, when your dread comes, when your dread comes like a storm and your calamity. And you can continue reading there. And, you know, that's an example of some pretty strong language in the Old Testament of, you could say, I would, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong there, but, you know, I argue that's, you know, God essentially kind of, you know, that you could argue that that's from God there. And, you know, in that situation, I had to maybe understand the context, but, you know, you have some really strong language in the Old Testament of calamity and destruction and harsh language. Yet in the New Testament, you got Jesus come along, and he uses although he used harsh language at times, and you even pointed out particularly at the Pharisees, and, you know, the religious elite of the day. But, you know, he uses language that says, you know, love your enemies as the Father loves your enemies. So I'm kind of torn as a Christian. I'm torn. You know, I understand the different views on hell that are out there, and I kind of lean towards the traditional view is got some issues, but I'm kind of torn between the universalistic view versus the conditionalist view or annihilationism. And I just look at these debates that go on right now between the Christians and the non-Christians. And I know these Christians are wrong for just being so nasty at these people in response.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do you say about this? Where's the balance? I mean, explain to me why the Old Testament seems so harsh, yet in many places in the New Testament, it seems the opposite. How can you reconcile the two?
You know, I don't really see the Old Testament being more harsh than the New Testament. Like you said, Jesus was pretty harsh with the Pharisees. And the Old Testament's pretty harsh on people who are, you know, giving God the finger but claiming to be his chosen people. I mean, when I say giving God the finger, they're worshiping idols. They're neglecting all of his commandments. And the prophets are sent to tell them that they need to turn around, and they kill the prophets. But those guys were every bit as bad as the Pharisees, if not worse. And so, I mean, for the prophets to speak for God and speak harshly about what's going to happen to them, to me, that's not really much different than Jesus speaking harshly to the Pharisees about the judgment that's coming. Now, one thing we can see, though, is Jesus, when he predicted the horrible things that were going to come on Jerusalem because of the sins of the Pharisees and people like that, he wept. We read that in the 19th chapter of Luke. When Jesus came toward the city, he saw it and he wept over it because he said, if you had only known what would have been for your good, but now it's hidden from your eyes, and you're going to be thrown, your enemies are going to come, they're going to level you to the ground, not one stone to be left on another, you and your children within you will be wiped out. And he wept over them. He said some pretty harsh words, but he did it with tears in his eyes. So did Jeremiah in the Old Testament. Jeremiah was the weeping prophet. He was giving the exact same message to Israel or Judah in his day, that the Babylonians were going to come and destroy Jerusalem and carry the people off and slaughter them. The very thing that Jesus was warning Jerusalem about in his day, Jeremiah was, and they both did it with tears. So I think both of them reflect the heart of God about that. Jesus wept at the tomb of Lazarus just because, you know, he was so sympathetic toward the suffering of mankind and was so grieved to see how death, you know, bereaves people of loved ones and such. Jesus said to Jerusalem, 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 how many times I would have gathered your children as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not. He says, therefore, it's going to go badly for you. And he went into the Olivet Discourse, where he predicted the horrible things that would come upon Jerusalem in AD 70. So, I mean, I just see pretty much the same attitude in the Old Testament as the New. And what I don't see is the same attitude in some of these modern Christians. When you say, as you're reading these Christian responses, you know that they're wrong. And what's interesting is you're a Christian and I'm a Christian, and we both know that they're wrong. If we who are Christians know they're wrong, how much wronger must they seem to the non-Christian who reads them? But you see, it's funny because it's been a very long time since I've been around any Christians who are harsh and unloving toward the gays. When people say that Christians are gay haters or whatever, I always think, what Christians are we talking about here? I'm immersed in Christian fellowship. I'm with Christians in meetings all over the place, and I don't know of any Christians that are in my circles that I would say are haters or harsh or, you know, anything like that. The Christians I know aren't that way. But then you go online, and I think the comments online, you know, under news stories and under videos and YouTube, so I think the comment section is the repository for the outpouring of the minds of the least intelligent people, both Christian and non-Christian. I'm not saying no one who comments there is smart, but what little I've done of perusing the comment sections on internet sites gives me the impression that maybe one person in 5 to 10 who post there has a brain in their head. And that includes Christians and non-Christians. You know, I mean, it just there are smarter, better Christians. Unfortunately, the internet puts on display the worst of our breed, and unfortunately gives people the impression that this is what Christianity is like, and I'm sorry to see it.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, I've got to take another call if I have time. I don't have much time.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Steve.
God bless you. Bob from Issaquah, you've been waiting a long time, but we don't have very much time, so go ahead. Thanks for calling.
I was going to ask you, Steve, about John 6, getting into discussions with Roman Catholics and how they interpret that to be their explanation for the literal body and blood of Christ. And I see it as verse 40 and 47 as literal, and then Christ uses figurative speech to show then that you must appropriate him as pure spiritual food. But I don't even see where this has anything to do with what they call the Eucharist and all. So that was my question.
I agree with you, brother. I don't think that Jesus is talking about the Eucharist here. And I'm not sure how anyone could think he was. Just because he uses language of eat his flesh and drink his blood, and that sounds like it could connect with the Eucharist if you tried to make it. You'd have to force it to, though, because Jesus speaks as if eating his flesh and drinking his blood is something that some people were currently doing and some people were not. He says, whoever eats, that's present tense, whoever is eating my flesh and drinking my blood has present life, present tense, has eternal life. So he's not talking about something future. He's talking about what was going on right there in the crowd. His disciples were among those that were eating his flesh and drinking his blood at that very moment, whereas the unbelievers were not. And he makes it very clear, he that hears my words and believes in him who sent me shall have everlasting life. And that's what eating his flesh and drinking his blood means. Now, he can't be referring to the Eucharist because his disciples were not eating the Eucharist at that time. In fact, that was the Passover. When Jesus said this in John 6, it was a year before Jesus established the Lord's Supper. It was Passover in John 6, and it was another Passover a year later when Jesus established the Lord's Supper. So he couldn't be talking about the Lord's Supper when he says, whoever is eating my flesh and drinking my blood, because no one was taking the Eucharist a year before the Last Supper. And you're right. I don't think it has anything to do with the Eucharist. Roman Catholics and maybe some others get a lot of mileage out of the language there and apply it to the Eucharist because it just sounds so suited to it. But they have to take it entirely out of its context. And frankly, a lot of people don't mind doing that. A lot of people decide what they want the Bible to teach, and then they'll take any scripture out of context they can to make it sound like their doctrine is biblical. But I'm with you. They're off the beaten path here. This is not the right way to go. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. Remember, this weekend, tomorrow night, I'll be speaking in Hollister, California, on the subject, How Can We Know That the Bible's True? And day after tomorrow, in Santa Cruz, California, I'll be speaking on a Christian response to same-sex marriage. Information about where and when those meetings are can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com, under the tab that says Announcements, thenarrowpath.com. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to donate to help us pay the radio bills to keep us on the air, you can go to that website I mentioned or write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or again, just go to thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. God bless you.